Welcome to Conversations Different, a podcast from the Santa Fe New Mexican about the interesting people and issues of Northern New Mexico. This is Inez Russell Gomez, and this week we are focusing on the strange case of a fatal shooting on a movie set. After nearly 3 years, Hollywood star Alec Baldwin is going to stand trial in July on a charge of involuntary manslaughter. With us is Phaedra Haywood, criminal justice reporter for the Santa Fe New Mexican. As she has been throughout this case, Phaedra will be in the courtroom when the trial starts. Welcome, Phaedra.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is kind of a weird story because it's very tragic, but because of the celebrity factor, the intention on it, not from Santa Fe really, because I don't think most of our readers are that interested comparatively to the rest of the world.
I would say that's accurate. When we had stories about it during the Hannah trial, they weren't even in the top 10 for local readership, even though they were blowing up online all around on Twitter. I had 33,000 hits on my Twitter account, but barely any hits on the local story.
That's so interesting. I remember when Coy Griffin got found guilty, I was the first one to tweet it for some reason, and I was one of the top five engaged journalists in the world that week. It was a highlight of my social media career. It will never be equaled. But this is a really serious thing because, of course, a woman died. Helena Hutchins, cinematographer, mother, wife, beloved daughter, was doing her job. They were rehearsing for the movie Rust. And what happened? Tell us what happened October 2021.
Well, according to most accounts I've seen, they were doing a walkthrough of a scene in a church building at the movie ranch, Bonanza Creek Ranch, here south of Santa Fe. And he was supposed to draw, he being Alec Baldwin, his character, Harlan Rust.
Harlan Rust, that's
yes.
Right.
He was supposed to do a cross draw, taking his weapon out of a holster, and he was sort of practicing with it, and he pulled it out, and according to prosecutors, cocked a hammer, pulled the trigger, and it ended up hitting Helena, who was behind a camera that was in the room, and after it passed through her body, it hit the director, Joel Souza, injured him in the shoulder.
Wow. And even if he'd pulled the trigger, there should not have been a bullet in the chamber. I mean, that's part of the problem, is there was live ammunition in the gun, which on a movie set is not supposed to happen.
Correct. And as you know, the armorer on the film, Hannah Gutettis Reed, was tried and convicted of involuntary manslaughter for her role in that, because she was essentially the person responsible for screening the weapons and ammunition that came onto the set. So according to prosecutors, that ammunition was introduced onto the set accidentally by her and without her knowledge, that she didn't know it, and then sort of spread its way through the set. So I think they determined that 6 live bullets got mixed in with dummy rounds and blank rounds on the set, and they were at various places. One was in the revolver that he was holding in that scene. One was in a bandolier that he was wearing. I think a couple were on an ammo cart. So they had already started migrating around the set.
Wow. And there's lawsuits trying to focus on where that ammunition came and should it have ever gotten there. And that's a whole other thing that we're not going to get into today. But there's like many layers of responsibility that seem to not work.
Right. And that's, as you say, at issue in the civil and criminal cases, as the layers of responsibility. And I think that's been one of the challenges in some of the criminal cases, is that we're not all familiar with what are the roles of responsibility or the layers of responsibility on a movie set. As we're investigating the sheriff's office or whatever, they're investigating as if, you know, it's a crime that happened among the citizenry where...
Now, I mean, anyone who shoots guns knows that you're always supposed to check to see if it's loaded. You're always not supposed to point it unless you're actually trying to shoot and kill somebody. But obviously, we're not in a movie where there's a person who's responsible for checking the gun, and where if we're pointing it, we're play acting.
Right. So that's been, you know, introduced at Hannah's trial, was some experts on movie scene, you know,
protocols,
yep. But also experts on just gun handling, muzzle control. And as you say, never point a weapon at someone unless you intend to shoot them. So what standard are we going to hold Mr. Baldwin to, I think, is
And that's part of his defense. And then I would suspect on the prosecution side, part of the defense is that he pulled the trigger, which in a rehearsal, perhaps he shouldn't have. And they're going to have to prove that this gun couldn't go off unless they pulled the trigger, I guess. And that'll be part of all the tests and all the things that have led to this taking so long to get to trial.
Yeah, those issues are still they're still the subject of motions that are being filed today.
Oh, my goodness.
So whether or not the gun could or couldn't have fired without the trigger being pulled is, of course, central to the case, in part because Mr. Baldwin has said he didn't pull the trigger. And then there was an FBI report saying the gun couldn't have fired without the trigger being pulled unless. And so there's always a qualification. So there's unless these perfect set of circumstances existed. Right. So it's not a bright line, but...
No, this is one of those really, it's going to depend, you know, it depends, I think, on the jury. Do you get people who shoot a lot who might have really firm opinions? You don't point the gun. Do you get people who hate guns because this is Santa Fe and lots of people don't like them? Or do you get people who might be in the movie business and understand the protocol? So I think the selection of the jury is going to be key in what happens.
Yeah, and I think that's been one of the difficulties with this case is getting anyone to treat it like any other case. I mean, a lot of times when they're choosing a jury, they're trying to choose jurors who've never heard of the case or never heard of the parties and don't have some prior knowledge.
And who don't love Alec Baldwin, right, because he was Jack Donahue for all those years.
Even if someone had, you know, been living under a proverbial rock for the last 3 years and not heard about this case.
Yeah.
His face could be familiar to them because he has had such a long movie career. So I think they will be hard-pressed to find someone that doesn't know who he is.
Right.
And that's going to color their perception.
Well, they managed to do it for Donald Trump. So, you know, one hopes they can find an objective, you know, and fair. Because it's not as though you don't have opinions, but you have to set them aside to do your work. And to listen to the evidence and to be fair and all of the things that we expect our jurors to do. So one of the things from the outside, just going back to the very beginning, is that it took a year to do the investigation into what happened on the set that day. And for just regular people on the streets, it was like, why did it take that long? And that was in the sheriff's office. That wasn't the DA at that point. So I know they were being very careful, dotting all their I's and crossing their T's, but that was a very long investigation.
Right. And some of the reasons that have been given for that are the number of people that were on set. And then, of course, there was this sort of geographical distance for many of the witnesses and stuff. For example, Mr. Baldwin, when they were trying to get his phone records, you know, it wasn't just a straight search warrant. They had to get a search warrant that would be valid in New York City. And, you know, there were some logistics. That,
right. And the FBI gun testing took a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we will take a quick break and be back in a moment with Conversations Different. Remember, we're available wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks, Inez. This is Patrick Dorsey, publisher of the Santa Fe New Mexican. We hope you're enjoying this episode of Conversations Different with Inez Russell Gomez. Great local content is only possible with a talented staff dedicated to bringing you the best local content possible. For that staff to do its work, we need your support by subscribing to the Santa Fe New Mexican. If you're already a subscriber, thank you. And if not, there's never been a better time to subscribe. In addition to our home-delivered newspaper that comes with full digital access, we also provide digital-only subscriptions for SantaFeNewMexican.com. We'll also be releasing more online-only audio and video programming moving forward. The Santa Fe New Mexican has been here for nearly 175 years, and we want to continue being your source for local news and information. Visit us at SantaFeNewMexican.com/subscribe or call us at 505-986-3010. Thank you.
We are back with Conversations Different, speaking to Phaedra Haywood, our ace crime reporter at the Santa Fe New Mexican. She will be in the courtroom, as she was at the trial of armorer Hannah Gutierrez-Reed. And let's talk a little bit about Hannah. She was charged with involuntary manslaughter and convicted. The jury did not take very long, and that's the same charge that Alec Baldwin faces.
Correct. It's a fourth degree felony punishable by 18 months in prison. And that was the sentence that she got. Yeah. And that's what he faces as well if convicted.
Yeah, the judge's statement was pretty stark in which she said a woman is dead basically because you did not do your job.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, that's harsh, but it's also true. And Alec's role is a little interesting because, and I don't know if this comes in the criminal trial. I call him Alec, you call him Mr. Baldwin, but I feel so close to him. He's also the producer of Rust. So in the criminal trial, will they bring in any alleged culpability because he was running such a, let's shall we say, a frugal set? And before the shooting happened, there was concern that it wasn't a safe set. Does any of that play into actually the moment of shooting, or is this just about this one man with a gun?
I think that will come up because it did come up in Hannah's trial as well. And part of what they introduced in the Hannah trial was the results of an OSHA investigation. And when OSHA was looking at it, and they did do some findings, and I think they fined them $100,000.
Yes, they lowered it from $134,000.
It was the highest OSHA fine in our state history. And a lot of that discussion was during Hannah's trial, they were trying to point out, well, they didn't find her guilty of anything. But that investigation was looking at the management, the running of the set, not the employees, but the producers, the managers. And they did find Some faults,
right.
Yeah, with
that's
management,
gonna be,
and I think that will reflect on him.
Yeah, when push comes to shove, this was a workplace accident, a fatal workplace accident.
Absolutely. I mean, the argument that on Baldwin's side is that, you know, well, he shouldn't have pulled the trigger, or, you know, as you say, people in the West that handle guns a lot, they have a real knowledge of muzzle control and what's going on with guns. But the other argument is that, to him, to his experience, it was like a paperweight, right? It was already supposed to be vetted. It should have been like a box of Kleenex. Like, yeah, he didn't
expect. It wasn't a weapon. It was a prop.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think that's really a decent argument. But at the same time, the reality is there's a dead woman and her family will never have her again. And that's just, not that the jury is going to know this, but his actions in the press, if you're not on the jury, probably didn't make you feel sorry for, you know, how he seemed really tragically sad at the beginning. And then he just started saying ridiculous things. And now he's going to be in a reality show. And it's like remorse doesn't seem part of his vocabulary at this point from the outside.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, there were three people charged in this case,
right?
And the first one, Dave Halls, the assistant director, he took a plea right away. He testified at Hannah's trial. He said, I made a mistake. And, you know, some of the sentiment that I'm hearing from the public is that people like that. They like people taking accountability. And there's been some criticism of Alec or Mr. Baldwin not admitting that there was some fault, or, you know, denying he pulled the trigger and those sort of things.
Right. And it's kind of the same with Hannah Gutierrez Reed, in that not only, you know, did she, and everyone has a right to a defense, there's no question about that, but she put up a very good defense, you know, expensive lawyers, they fought everything, and now she's appealing the sentence. And you think about the family of a victim in this case, they have to go through this every single time it's drawn out. So when you balance whether it was your fault completely or not, if you had a part in it, I wonder at what point do we say, I did it, I'm going to jail, you know, that's it. And then you move on with your life after and try to be a better person. I don't know.
Right. And there's public sentiment, what do people think of me? But then there are, what are the legal consequences for me?
Right.
For her, the legal consequence was actually incarceration.
Which is horrible. I mean, she's a young woman, and very, you know, her demeanor at the trial, you could tell she was struck by the gravity of everything. I felt very, very sorry for her. I wonder if this has made the New Mexico film industry look at, are we doing a good job as an industry of making sure sets are safe?
I think it's definitely brought those issues up, and it's making people tread more carefully, right? Because on one hand, they don't want to chase the business away. But on the other hand, we're really in the spotlight here. And there were some issues with the cameraman, you know, walking off the set that day, actually the morning of the shooting. I think six union camera members had walked off. So their complaints, you know, one of which was like being not being given lodging when you talk about running a frugal set. And I think one of their complaints was that they weren't being put up in Santa Fe. And so that
they had to drive from Albuquerque,
work a long day, drive to Albuquerque, come back. And that could be a safety issue.
Yeah, because if you're exhausted, you don't do as good a job.
From what I hear, part of the reason that Helena was on the set that day in the church was because all of the camera crews weren't there. And normally they have this little setup outside where you can watch what's happening. But because that wasn't operating that day, she was inside looking right directly at the camera.
Oh, so if things had worked, she would have been on the outside looking in, so to speak.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, yeah, I don't know perhaps. For sure, but that is one of the things that has been discussed in trial.
Oh, you think about one of those instances, and this is true of a lot of tragedies, everything that could go wrong goes wrong. And it collides in this point of no return and someone loses their life.
Right, right. Yeah. But it was so unexpected, I think, for the people on there. I mean, one of the things that struck out to me was that Joel Souza, when he was taken to the hospital with a bullet lodged in his shoulder, the medical personnel were telling him, you have a bullet in your body, because he was like, what happened? What happened? Right. And he was like, no, you don't understand. We were on a movie set. Those bullets aren't real.
Oh, my gosh.
Like he didn't even really want to believe he'd been shot, because to his mind, there are not bullets in that gun on that set. Like, they're not treating those guns as real.
Right. And because they aren't supposed to be.
Right. They don't have to be. I mean, that's also an argument that we've heard a lot about. They could have used rubber guns. They could have used computer generated special effects or.
Yeah, there should be. I mean, this doesn't happen often in Hollywood, but every 10 to 15 to 20 years, somebody is shot and killed because of something going wrong on a set. And they have pretty much proven that you can take care of the special effects of the gun in the post-production. So why even risk it?
Right.
On that note, we'll take a quick break and be back in a moment with another segment of Conversations Different.
My name is Maria Jose Rodriguez Cadiz, and I am the executive director with Solis Sexual Assault Services. Our mission is to prevent sexual violence and empower survivors of sexual violence through restoring dignity, strength, and resiliency. For almost 51 years, Solis has reduced the impact of sexual violence. We do it by focusing on human rights, social justice, hope, and dignity. We believe survivors are experts in their own experiences and acknowledge that empowering them is crucial to their healing. Our advocacy, forensic interviewing, and therapy services are centered to their needs. Our sexual violence prevention programs in schools and community is just as important. Please check our website at findsolace.org. And if in need, you can call our 24/7 hotline, which is 800-721-7273. Your support is crucial to the lives of survivors. Thank you. Gracias.
We're back with Conversations Different, discussing the upcoming Rust movie trial. In that, Alec Baldwin is accused of involuntary manslaughter in the case of a gun going off with a live bullet on a movie set. One of the things that is sort of interesting from the outside is just the fact that people are so interested in this case. How many media people are expected to be at the trial?
Yeah, there was 88 different outlets registered to attend part of the Gutierrez retrial. So I'm imagining probably equal or more.
Yeah, because he's a big star.
Yeah, and they were all the big ones, you know, NBC, ABC, CBS. I was teasing the girls over there, all the BCs. But there was Reuters sent someone, Variety sent someone, New York Times, LA Times.
Wow. If I were still a people stringer, they might have hired me to cover it.
Yeah, it was very interesting. They had a bunch of like portable television studios set up outside the courthouse. And some of these journalists really impressed me because they would be in there, you know, taking down notes about the testimony and then go out at the lunch break and record a live spot, you know, just moving straight from the reporting to the actual
And they have
reporting.
To think on their feet and talk.
Yeah, and look and, nice yep. and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, print journalists, we don't have to comb our hair necessarily, although you always have your hair beautifully
And this was
done.
The first time that Court TV was here in our courthouse in the First Judicial District doing live streaming, and there was some interesting takes on how that all worked. They did have a slight delay for profanity, I think, so I was able to actually beat the television by about 10 seconds
yes.
with the verdict in the Gutierrez trial.
I love it. I love it. That's right. I saw you first. I was waiting and looking because it was a little faster than I expected, but it was kind of what I expected just because that was her job.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're talking, you know, having me on this show, which I appreciate. A lot of other people have asked me to be on their shows. I've gotten calls from radio stations in Germany, like just very random outlets that want to cover this.
He's somebody that churns a lot of interest.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people that like him. Yeah. And then there are some people that strongly dislike him, too.
Yes.
He's a little bit polarizing for people.
I think that is exactly true. And I always loved him because I loved 30 Rock. But I don't look at him exactly the same way after that interview with George Stephanopoulos, where he's going on about the trigger and what he did and just I mean, but I can't imagine how awful he feels either because he didn't mean to do it. It's just, it's a tragedy. It's a
right.
real tragedy.
And it has taken on a life of its own. As you mentioned, there's a bunch of civil cases filed by all kinds of people that were on that set. Everyone from the medic to the script supervisor. Hutchins' husband settled with Baldwin and some of the film defendants early on in the case. And I think the terms of that were not ever made completely public. But one of the terms is that the husband is being named as a co-producer of some sort on the movie. But
I was like, who would want to see that?
Oh, a million people. I mean, I think a lot of people would like to.
Yeah.
If anything, probably would make the film more attractive to the public.
I keep thinking about what it says about us in America, the world right now, that people are more interested in a movie star than they are in the poor woman who was shot and killed.
Her friends are also making a documentary about her.
That's worthwhile because she sounded like a fascinating person with a great career and just an interesting life. Because she was, if I remember right, she was Ukrainian.
She was. And I actually regret that we haven't done as much on her as we've done on this sort of legal process, because every time I do hear people talk about her, it's with a sort of sense of awe or being very impressed with her creativity and the way she saw things as a cinematographer. And she apparently worked really hard to get here.
Yeah. I mean, getting into any Hollywood movie is no easy thing. You have to have talent and drive and a lot of hard work.
And her family still lives in Ukraine.
Oh, so they're dealing with everything over there.
Yeah.
One of the things that was just, I mean, this whole case has been bizarre. So they file the charges and then they put an enhanced gun penalty. But then it turns out that that law hadn't taken effect. So the DA filed incorrectly. Then they hired a special prosecutor, but she was a legislator. And they found this weird version of the law that says this branch can't help this branch. And so she gets kicked out. Then the DA, Mary Carmack Altwies, was trying it, but then she decided to get another special prosecutor, so she didn't try it. Then it came up in the DA's race, and it's cost how many tens of thousands of dollars?
It's in the hundreds of thousands right now. I don't have the exact number, but I think it's somewhere in the $400,000 range. She had initially asked the state for an additional $635,000 in funding to prosecute it, and she said she was going to put on four trials for that. I mean, that was the estimation, that that's what it would cost her to do four trials. She did get the money. She got it in two buckets. One came from, I think, straight from the DFA, but the other was a legislative appropriation. And I think part of the legislative appropriation reverted back because it had to be spent in that calendar year or something like that. And so the $635,000 has not totally been spent yet. But I did ask the district attorney's office at one point if the lower number of trials was going to bring the cost down because, you know, they had estimated for four trials and here we're only going to have two. And they said maybe, but not that much, because they said a lot of the money would be spent on the front end on expert
witnesses
and stuff like that. So, yeah, you know, a good portion of that $400,000 thereabouts has already been spent and we're not done yet.
And that was what Challenger Marco Cerna kept bringing up, that they were spending too much and that as the district attorney should just prosecute it themselves. And I think that was resonating with people, but it obviously didn't because she got reelected in a landslide. So that was kind of one of those interesting political twists where you think people are agreeing with the guy who's complaining, but it turns out not really, or maybe just the loud ones.
Yeah, I mean, I think people might have agreed or might criticize spending on this, but I don't think it was enough for them to choose a different candidate.
Well, and the thing is we wrote an editorial about, you know, when she decided to charge it. If she didn't charge, people would say you're letting a big shot get away. If you did charge, it's like, oh, you just want headlines. And why are you wasting our money on something like this when it's obviously a tragic accident? And, you know, what's the answer to that? I don't know.
I don't either, but there's almost no pleasing everybody all of the time, right? And in some aspects, her job is a prosecutor, so she couldn't go wrong in prosecuting, right?
Right.
It seems like that's your job. That's what you're going to do.
And I also think, you know, in her credit, is that she took very seriously. A woman died.
Yes.
And the actions of these people, whether, you know, inadvertent or negligence or whatever, led to the death of this woman. And if nothing else, a trial lets you lay out the facts so that people can decide, you know, was it involuntary manslaughter or was it a tragic accident?
Yeah, and I think far be it for me to try and get inside the mind of the judge, Mary Marlo Sommer, who's presiding over it, but she's had to decide a couple of motions to dismiss. And I get the feeling that she wants a jury to decide. Like, they don't want this to be decided on a technicality, or they, you know, they kind of want the facts to go to the jury, as you said, and to have someone decide. One of the things that struck me about it, though, is part of what the district attorney's office has said is, you know, no one is above the law. And we are going to prosecute him, even though he's
a
Hollywood
guy.
Star and all of that. But the funny thing is, so they try and say, well, he's like anyone else, and we're all the same under the law. But there's nothing about this case resembles what it would have looked like if it was just an average citizen. Not the amount of money we've spent, not the amount of time we've spent, not the hundreds of pages, like forest full of trees of paper that both sides have filed. You know, I mean, it's very routine for them to file a motion to exceed the page limit in their pleadings. And we see these pleadings going to 100, 300, you know, 200, 300 pages. And it's a fourth degree felony. I mean, it's a serious charge and someone did die. But in the terms of penalties or in complexity of a case, trial wise, in a regular day,
this isn't like a death penalty case.
It would have been done by now to some extent, a fourth degree felony charge. They would have pled it out or they would have, you know, but nothing has actually gone the way it would normally.
Right. That's kind of what I was reading to prepare for this. The cases, it's like whatever you think is going to happen, it's not going to happen. And now the trial is starting in Santa Fe in high season. I'm like, where are these reporters going to stay? They're going to be driving in from Española every day.
Yeah, that's a great point. It is really going to amp up the circus, so to speak, that's been happening around it.
On that note, we'll take a quick break and be back in a moment with another segment of Conversations Different.
It's a new day in New Mexico, and the doors to boundless opportunity are open as tens of thousands of New Mexicans reach higher to pursue a dream, broaden their horizons, and retrain for a better job. With the New Mexico Lottery and Opportunity Scholarships, you could build yourself a better future anywhere in the state. You put in the hard work, we'll help with the costs. For eligibility details, visit reachhighernm.com.
Thank you.
back with Phaedra Haywood discussing the upcoming Rust trial. We wanted to talk about what to expect during what is going to be a contentious and witness-packed trial. As we are recording this, the judge is deciding a final motion to actually dismiss the charges against Alec Baldwin, but we predict that she is going to go ahead and let the jury decide. What should people expect at this trial?
Well, as you mentioned, there is a pending motion right now to dismiss the case based on the state's destruction of evidence, the destruction of the gun. And if, as we predict, the judge denies that, I'm forecasting that. I could be wrong, but I think the judge wants this to go to the jury and not have it, you know, decided on a motion like that. But so if she denies it, it'll still be an issue in the case, right? This will still be a big point of contention. It's a big piece of evidence.
How can I prove that I didn't pull the trigger if I can't examine the weapon in the same way that the prosecution and that the state did? And
exactly.
And really it was the FBI lab where this happened. Is that right?
Yes, yes. So it happened in the FBI lab while they were testing it. They were conducting this accidental discharge testing to see if the gun could have gone off without the trigger being pulled, because that's been Mr. Baldwin's, you know, chief defense, is that he didn't pull the trigger on that gun. So that will come up again at trial, and I'm sure be a hard fought. And as even as they were discussing it in a motions hearing this week, you know, that was brought up by the state saying, well, it's not worth throwing the case out over it. You can cross-examine. It's an issue for you to cross-examine our witnesses about. So that'll be something that we should expect to see a lot of questioning about.
I know this is actually a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is Alec Baldwin going to be at the trial? Because he's the defendant and the defense is supposed to be at the trial. But I don't know if he's required to.
I believe he is.
Okay.
I believe he is. I don't think he can waive his own appearance at the trial, partially because there's a liberty interest. You know, most now, since the pandemic, a lot of cases are being held virtually. But most of the cases that are not held virtually are where your liberty is at interest, you know, a plea hearing, a sentencing hearing, or a trial where he could hypothetically be found guilty and taken into custody at the end of the proceeding.
Wow. And that's one of the reasons, as we talked about in previous segments on this podcast, that there's going to be a lot of media. But before there's, you know, before they can get in to cover the trial, they're going to have to pick a jury. And how many people do you think, are they calling up an extra bunch of folks to be potentially on the jury? Or is this just a normal jury pool?
That's a great question. I don't actually know the answer, but I think they called two pools, between 70 and 90 people, I want to say, for the Hannah-Gatettis trial. And they did pick it in one day. And they talked about this a little bit this week about whether or not they would need more than one day. And Alex Spiro, who's one of Baldwin's attorneys, said he has no doubt they'll be able to pick a jury in one day. And he's never had it have to go over into more days. As you may have heard, the parties were sort of asking if they could have more time because the trial is set to last from the 10th to the 19th. And they were asking the judge this week, oh, could it maybe go on to the 26th? And she said, no, you're going to have to get your argument in this time. So there's about 75 witnesses who've been identified possibly as being called. 13 of those are expert witnesses, and they take a little bit longer. And so there was a lot of discussion yesterday about them having to pare down those witnesses or get them in their time. So of that time, it'll be broken out. The state will get 5 or 6 days to present their case, and then the defense will get 2 or 3 days to present their case, because that's the amount of time that each side has told the judge that previously that they need.
So all of a sudden saying, no, we actually need another week isn't going to cut it.
No, the judge has said in no uncertain terms that's not going to happen. So she said that she would put them on a time clock if need be.
Talk about who the prosecutor is going to be, because obviously the First Judicial District brought the charges. Mary Carmack Altwies is the DA, but she didn't try it. And the special prosecutor who tried Hannah Gutierrez-Reed is not the special prosecutor this time.
It is. It is the same special prosecutor. Carrie Morrissey will still be leading the prosecution. Her second chair, co-counsel, Jason Lewis, is no longer on the case. He stepped down because apparently he had a scheduling conflict. And they've added Erlinda Ocampo-Johnson.
Okay.
So she's co-chair.
So that's the new person that I was thinking of.
So that's the new person. They had a motion to court to possibly allow them to add a third person. And the judge said no. She didn't say you can't add a third person, but they had proposed possibly adding a third person who would have been an employee of the DA's office on unpaid leave. And the judge ruled on that in a written motion recently. And she said, no, I allowed you to appoint a special prosecutor based on the finding that you didn't have the resources in your office to staff this. And this would be contrary to the finding that I made that allowed you to have a special prosecutor. So, you know, possibly if they had tried to add someone else from the private bar, they would have been allowed, but they were not allowed to add a third person. So those two women are going up against a team of 6 to 8 people. Sort of it's a shifting number at any given time that are on Baldwin's side. And that's being led by two lawyers who are based in New York. But there's also a local counsel, Heather LeBlanc, who's based in Albuquerque, who's on that team.
Right. Yeah, because you always have to have somebody who's licensed in New Mexico to help practice. I'm just wondering how much his defense cost. You know, I'm just thinking about this is a lot of money.
Yeah, I can't even venture a guess. Maybe if we get to talk again, I'll do some research on it. But you have to consider that these lawyers make bare minimum, probably $300 an hour at their level, maybe more, $500, $800. I really don't know what lawyers of that caliber make at that firm. I mean, we do know that the state got a pretty good deal on Linda Campo-Johnson. I think she's only getting paid $125 an hour.
Yeah, that's actually not very much for a lawyer of that stature.
Right.
And I've heard she's quite a good prosecutor.
Yeah, I don't know that much about her. So I was thinking of doing a little bit more of a who's who coming up in advance of the trial. So if you all want to keep an eye on the paper, we'll have some pictures and just some background on some of these people ahead of the trial, including some of the people that will, some of the 75 witnesses that we expect them to call.
Yeah, I think that's important. And I'm less interested in the experts and more interested in the people who were on the set and were around, you know, when this happened and what they saw, you know, what was the atmosphere, you know, were they pushed to the limits to save money, you know, all of the questions that come up and how this happened.
Right, right. I'm interested to see what happens if Hannah Gutierrez-Reed comes back and if she gets on the stand. There's been some, you know, debate about whether or not she would have to testify. And there was a motion. The state was asking the court to, you know, give her immunity, use immunity to have her testimony during this trial, saying that it would not, you know, be used against her in any way so that she wouldn't be claiming the fifth on all of these questions, partially because during a pretrial interview, that's what she had done. When she was asked a lot of questions, she was standing on her Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. And the state said, well, you should, you know, force her to testify here if Baldwin's team is going to get to use statements she's made in the past in their defense, we should also get to ask her about statements that would incriminate him. And the judge said no, she denied that. And she said, you're just going to have to accept that she's an uncooperative witness. And so you can still call her, but you might have to anticipate that she's going to have the right to stand on the fifth on the stand, in part because she still has a pending appeal.
That makes sense, because I was just thinking, well, she's already been found guilty. Well, she's already incriminated, but she is trying to...
She has a pending appeal, and she also has a pending criminal case still. She's charged with unlawful carrying of a firearm in a licensed liquor establishment for something that I think the state discovered during the investigation of this case. The allegation, I believe, is that she brought a firearm into a bar in downtown Santa Fe.
Ooh.
So she's charged with that, and so that's also pending.
Oh, wow.
And,
so that's bad judgment after bad judgment, potentially.
Well, if that's what the... the prosecution has said in the past. So it's possible that she could be called at trial and sit on the stand and refuse to answer many of the questions.
Right. Which, I don't know if that's just a bad look for her or if it it's going to be interesting to see the jury's reaction to that, because you wonder, what could she say? Would it be good for Mr. Baldwin? Would it be bad for Mr. Baldwin? Is she trying to protect him? Does she hate his guts now? You know, who knows? We don't know the backstory of the emotions that are going on. And uncooperative witnesses, I think we saw in the Trump trial, that one guy that was so awful really hurt the defense.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, all the people that are going to be from the set, you know, are they all going to be blaming him and saying that his behavior was not right, or are they going to be defending him as one of their own? And these things happen on movie sets. So, you know, Joe Souza, who was struck by one of the bullets, he testified sort of very neutrally at Hannah's trial that something went wrong, but he didn't lay blame. He didn't seem to be laying a lot of blame anywhere that, you know, indicating that it was an accident or
whatever. It's really, I think, a reminder how in just an instant, you know, everybody, you know, the poor cinematographer's life was ended. I mean, that's the worst possible outcome. And then everybody else participating in what, you know, should be a highlight of their lives, being on a movie, getting paid for it, all those things is disrupted. I mean, they don't pay witnesses to come back and testify. So if you have to come back to Santa Fe to testify, you have to fly yourself, get a hotel room. I mean, you think about just the piles of disruption that are occurring to everybody involved in what should have been a good thing.
Right. I'm not sure on whether the witnesses get any travel expenses or not. Yeah. They may.
Maybe they do.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's definitely changed a lot of lives in a split second.
So if I'm a reader or a, you know, a watcher of Hollywood, true crime, all of those things, what should I look for in the coverage of the trial and in the trial itself as it opens?
Well, you should look for a bunch of people, I would imagine. You know, as we've spoken about before, there'll be a bunch of media there. Close to 100 media outlets had registered for the last trial. I imagine this one will be bigger. There's a bunch of, you know, television outside and stuff. But, you know, look for Alec Baldwin to be on the stand in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And here's a tip for y'all. I'm not trying to have you mob the courthouse, but there are some seats set aside for the public. And they're on a first-come, first-served basis.
So if I get up at 6 o'clock and go stand in line, or 5 o'clock, yes, I could maybe get a seat.
Yeah. So if you want to see these people, these Hollywood types, and outlets from New York Times, LA Times, Reuters, BBC, CNN, Court TV, some of those people will be in Santa Fe. And so, you know, you were talking about if you're just a reader or a watcher of the courts, but also the entire city could probably see an impact or like meet some of the people that come here for that. I know they were staying all over downtown and, you know, discovering all the restaurants downtown. And so, you know, hearkening back to my old days as a fashion reporter, I would say we should look out for some outfits. We saw some interesting outfits in Hannah's trial, and I'll be interested to see what these, you know, city people are wearing. But, you know, it might be bringing some people to the city who have never been here before, or, you know, bringing, you know, it's brought a lot of attention internationally, nationally, to the area for better or for worse.
It sounds like it's going to be a lot of intense days over at the courthouse.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there's some intense days, a lot of fanfare, and then there's some days where you're looking at hundreds and hundreds of pictures of bullets for 9 hours on end. So it'll be a really exciting start, and then probably a slow middle, and probably a very exciting end.
Yeah, I think if I was going to go for the any day of the trial, I would love to see the closing arguments. Those are always my favorite part, because they really sum it up and make their case.
Yeah, openings, closings, and verdict. And those are the days to be there. And the verdict is going to be interesting. I mean, I can't imagine if they were to actually take him into custody.
Yeah, this is one of those cases. I have no great opinion on whether he's guilty, not guilty, and I have no clue what the jury's going to do given the evidence and how it shakes out, because it really depends how it's presented.
Absolutely. It's hard to predict juries.
Yeah.
You know, it's like trying to pick the winning lottery numbers or something. You're always going to be wrong. So. Yeah.
That's right. And I think what I always remember is that whatever I think of a case, I wasn't in there for 8 hours every single day. The jury was.
Right.
And they really do a thorough job and a fair job of going through the evidence and trying their best to come with a just verdict. That's been really impressive. I was on one grand jury and got kicked off several juries that they didn't want me for, but just that process over at the courthouse was really incredibly thorough and fair.
Yeah. When I'm sitting there in the trial a lot, I'm looking at their faces and just, you know, trying to get inside their head. What are they thinking? And, you know, hopefully we'll get some of them to talk to us after the trial. That can be hard. Sometimes people don't want that visibility. Yeah. They don't want to be known as the person who sent Alec Baldwin to jail or exonerated him. But other times people are really eager to talk about it and share. So we got one good guy after the Gattetis trial, and hoping to get a couple of people after this trial to talk about, you know, their reasoning for their decision.
And when that happens, except for appeals, we will be done. This case of criminal jurisprudence will be over for Santa Fe.
Yeah, and well, like you say, when we're done with the appeals, and that could take years, but yes, it'll definitely go down in history. You know, I had heard it described as the most famous trial in New Mexico history, and I'm not sure if that's totally correct. As we were talking about the other day, there are other trials as well, but it's definitely going to be one for the record books, as they say.
I guess all of our other big trials didn't happen in an age of social media, and that sort of changes the dynamic.
Absolutely, in terms of how many people can be watching and also having court TV.
Yeah.
I think I told you before, there's a huge audience for this story outside of New Mexico.
Yes.
If you watch the court TV feed during the Hannah Gattetis trial, the comments were coming in like just crazy, you know, just a steady stream of people from all over the country watching it live.
One more thing, Phaedra, how can people get, you know, up-to-date information on the trial as you're covering it? Because I imagine you'll be live tweeting at least some of it.
Yeah, I'm going to do my best. The City Desk is wanting 3 stories a day from the trial, so I'll be filing stories usually at 12, 3, and 6, but also trying to do live tweeting of sort of color, things I observe in the hallway, things that are happening instantly. Sometimes they do pictures, and my Twitter handle is at Phaedra Ann. That's at PHAEDRAANN.
All right. So pay attention and read at Phaedra Ann on Twitter, and we'll have 3 stories a day at our website, santafenewmexican.com. And on that note, this has been another Conversations Different. We'll be back next week.